Coming up, a Fred to Sam Lazaro report from India. It's officially illegal, but many Indian families still manage to see to it that they have more boys than girls. Also, activist Jim Wallace on overcoming the country's problems by serving the common good. And for this family, no computers, no cell phones, no errands, no work. Judy Valente on keeping the Sabbath.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. President Obama hosted the annual Easter prayer breakfast at the White House Friday, nearly a week after Western Christians celebrated the holiday. Leaders from many Christian traditions attended. The president called Easter a time to remember the sacrifice of Jesus and recommit to following his example. He reflected in particular on caring for the needy.
When we tend to the sick, when we console those in pain, when we sacrifice for those in need, wherever and whenever we are there to give comfort and to guide and to love, then Christ is with us.
The former Anglican Archbishop of Cape Town, South Africa, Desmond Tutu, is this year's recipient of the Templeton Prize, given to those who affirm life's spiritual dimension. It comes with the world's largest annual award, $1.7 million. Tutu was chosen for his work, quote, advancing spiritual practices such as love and forgiveness. Tutu was an outspoken critic of racial apartheid and later chaired South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. In a 2010 interview on this program, Tutu said he has never called himself an optimist.
I am a prisoner of hope, which is a different kettle of fish. Optimism is too light.
At the Vatican, Pope Francis this week paid homage to several of his papal predecessors. On Tuesday, the Pope prayed before the tomb of John Paul II on the 8th anniversary of his death. The day before, he became the first pope to visit excavations of the tomb of St. Peter under the basilica named for him. Also this week, the Vatican responded to questions about why Pope Francis usually speaks prayers rather than singing or chanting them. The spokesman said he believed it was due to a hoarseness in the Pope's voice. In an earlier interview, Francis called himself tone deaf. We have a Fred to Sam Lazaro story today about selecting babies by sex in India. The practice may be illegal, but many Indian families consistently manage to have fewer girl babies than boys.
For some months, Pooja, a 22-year-old mother of three, has been coming to this crisis counseling center in a lower middle-class neighborhood of Delhi. Pooja is trying to keep her family together. Her husband and in-laws, with whom she lived in the common tradition here, threw her out of the house. The problem, all three of her children are girls.
The family says they need sons to carry on their name. And since I have only three daughters, they tried to trick me into signing divorce papers so that their son could marry again. That led to some violence when I refused, and I had to run away to my mother's house for safety.
The preference for boy children dates back centuries, driven by religious custom.
Only boys can look after the parents. They are the only ones who can perform the last rites. They are the only ones who will continue the family lineage. If all that is there, then why will anybody want to have a girl child? And also on the top of that, you have to pay dowry.
Ranjana Kumari has studied the dowry system, which she says is mistakenly believed to have roots in Hindu scriptures.
This was never a practice anywhere prescribed, but certainly it was said that when the princess goes, she must carry a number of horses because she's used to certain level of comfort. And so it is the duty of the king to ensure the daughter is given the, and that gets distorted now. Even the poorest of the poor who can't afford 2 square meal a day will also have to buy things for the wedding of the daughter.
Dowries were outlawed half a century ago, but the system remains pervasive and adds a huge commercial dimension to marriage in India. With rising aspirations in a rapidly growing economy, sociologist Ravinder Kaur says daughters have become a financial liability.
They don't want to pay dowries, they want to receive dowries, they want to give more education to the boys than to the girls, because for them the boys are still more important.
India's census starkly bears out that bias. For every 1,000 male babies born, there are just 914 females, far fewer in some regions. In nature, the numbers are about equal. The gap began to widen in the 1990s with the advent of ultrasonography, allowing early detection of a fetus's sex. That's been blamed for the widespread abortion of female fetuses.
This is where your clinic is.
Abortion is legal in India, but it's illegal when done for sex selection. However, tracking the intent is almost impossible. As gynecologist Prakash Kakodkat admitted with startling candor in a story I reported in 2001, he does them routinely.
So you freely admit that you do basically contravene the law? I mean,
yes, most of us do, I would say. I often deny that. I mean,
do you face any legal sanctions for doing
that? No, that's what I said. There's no legal sanction because there is nothing on paper. I mean, who can ask you?
The lopsided sex ratio has only spread in recent years. 2 decades ago, it was mainly in the northern farm states where many families were entering the middle class, thanks to India's Green Revolution. Now, Kaur says it's in areas where a new middle class is emerging.
Places like Uttar Pradesh, Bihar, Odisha, which are becoming more prosperous, where there will be greater availability of technology and more incomes in the hands of families, they will tend to shape the family and sex select.
As these areas become more affluent, fertility rates, the number of children born per woman, are declining. That's welcomed by people concerned about population growth. These are some of India's most densely populated regions. But when it comes to gender balance, it's not good news.
You know, when you want a smaller family, then the squeeze is on the girls. Because, interestingly, suppose you are moving from a fertility of 4 to 3. Then you want 2 boys and 1 girl. So if a lot of families in populous states want 2 boys and 1 girl, then obviously there's going to be a great excess of boys.
She says the social consequences of this demographic shift are already visible in those northern farm states where there's a growing shortage of brides.
And as a result, men in these states have been importing brides from, let's say, the east of India, the south of India. They're sort of going shopping for brides wherever they can. And many people call it bride trafficking.
These marriages across India's diverse cultural landscapes can be fraught with social complication. But at the same time, Kaur sees an ever so slight improvement in the gender ratio in those states that saw early prosperity.
Once people reach the higher rungs of the middle class, which I call the stable middle class, they don't sex select. Then they tend to view girls and boys as being of equal value. So they don't really care whether they have 2 girls, whether they have 1 girl, 1 boy, etc.
But for many years, India will present a patchwork of progress, a worsening gender balance in many places, slight improvement in some. The Center for Social Research's Kumari sees one more positive development. That's a consequence of India's growing and urbanizing middle class. More girls are going to school.
As I said, that India is full of contradictions. On the one side, you see women in the villages still very disempowered. But on the other side, there is a brighter picture where we have largest number of doctors, lawyers, professionals. Our education level is going up for the girls. When you look at the new economy, girls have got a lot of new opportunities, you know, media, IT industry, banking, entertainment. Whichever sector you see, women are filling the ranks in a very major way.
Counseling center client Pooja never set foot in a school, but she wants an education for her daughters, and that's why she says she needs her husband's help to provide it.
Women are progressing more in society, and I need the support of their father so that they can grow up in a proper family, so that they can get a good education, so that they can grow up and have good marriages.
She'll have an uphill battle, socially if not legally, to provide her daughters with the family structure she calls ideal. But she says the best dowry her daughters could have is an education. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro in New Delhi.
Now, a conversation with Jim Wallace about his new book. It's called On God's Side, and it's an appeal to overcome the country's problems by serving the common good. Wallace is a religious activist, preacher, and editor of Sojourners magazine. He joins us today from New York. And our managing editor, Kim Lawton, is here with me in the studio. Jim, welcome. What is your definition of the common good?
You know, people are asking me what the common good is and what it means to be on God's side, and neither has certain answers, but I think they're the right questions. Let me give you my favorite from the book. This is from Catholic Social Teaching. I'll read it right from them. The common good is the whole network of social conditions which enable humans and groups to flourish. All are responsible for all. So I was taking a sabbatical to write this book and watching the news at night and saw we had forgotten this idea of the common good, and yet that's our traditions.
Jim, who
tell
says
us.
Who says what the common good is?
Well, the common good is found in all of our faith traditions, definitions like the Catholic one there, the Black churches. I found it back to John Chrysostom in the 4th century. So it's deeply in all our traditions, and the moral foundation of it is to love your neighbor as yourself. Now, in secular democratic traditions, it's also there in the Golden Rule. Treat others the way you want to be treated. So it's a fundamental principle of how you treat your neighbor and then who your neighbor is.
Jim, one thing I've noticed is that different people will say they have different ways of reaching the common good. So, for example, in some of the budget debates that I know you were involved in, you had some people saying the common good is served this way, and other people still using that language but coming up with a very different policy position. How do you reconcile that?
Mike Gerson, who's a Washington Post columnist and was a George Bush speechwriter, has a comment on the book. He says, Jim and I might disagree on some policy decisions, but his call for an active consideration of the common good is more timely and urgent than ever. I'm saying, let's have that debate on the principle of the budget that you raise. The principle from all our traditions is you have to protect the poor and vulnerable. So you can't reduce a deficit by increasing poverty. People on both sides could make that pledge, and then we could find a way to reform the public sector and the private sector in ways that protect the poor and vulnerable.
Jim, within many of the churches, there has been a kind of a split between those who emphasize salvation and, on the other hand, those who emphasize trying to build a kingdom on earth now.
Right.
Where are you on this, on both sides?
Well, I'm an evangelical, which means I want to take what the Bible says seriously. And if you look at the early chapters of Matthew, you see a kingdom breaking in that's supposed to change the world and us with it. So in the book, I've got a long conversation about your question. It says the kind of Jesus we believe in will determine the kind of Christians we're going to be. So I'm critical of what I call the atonement-only gospel, where there's no kingdom, there's no teaching, there's no change of anything but ourselves. That's not what the scriptures teach, but that's certainly in the church I grew up in. So a balance that changes individuals. I want to be changed in my life, but also we're supposed to change the world. Jesus came to change the world and us with it.
And Jim, along those lines, in your book you do talk a lot about that the common good is served not just through policies and politics, but also in individual decisions people make in their families, their lives. How does how I live my life in my personal life affect the common good?
I'm so glad you asked that question because a lot of people say, I can't change Washington or Wall Street. I'm saying the choices we make about how we treat our neighbors, those around us, our poor neighbors, those we may have to reach out to, our immigrant neighbors, our Muslim neighbors, our gay neighbors. Those choices will change the culture. We're seeing the one place Washington's getting it right is around immigration reform. And why? Because from the outside, they're hearing the faith community say, this for us is a moral issue. It's a gospel issue. And it's changing our politics. We're going to get that. All we're going to get this year, I think, is that. But it's going to happen because of the common good being practiced outside of Washington. It comes last to Washington.
But is it a movement, Jim, that you're trying to put together, a movement that essentially is a national lobby, or is it, as Kim was talking about, what people do in our own lives?
No, it's what people do in our own lives. Like William Wilberforce led the abolition movement, but it wasn't the parliamentarians. It was the movement that swept the country. So what we do in our own lives, and I mean our households. I got whole chapters on being dads and moms and parents, and I'm a Little League baseball coach. Those kind of life choices are what build social movements, and that's the only thing that ever changes politics. What we do in our own lives is what the book is about, and how that can change politics and culture. And just the first sentence of the book says, our life together can be better. And that's the hunger I think people are feeling now.
And Jim, just very briefly, you've been talking about some of these ideas for a long time. Other people have been talking about the common good. What makes you think things are different now, that there's a new receptivity now?
Well, first of all, watching the political narrative at night after being all day in the sabbatical I took, quiet and reflection and study and writing, the more I watched it at night, I wasn't engaging it, the more depressing it was. Polarized, paralyzed, hate, fear, anger. And I saw we've lost something very fundamental. So I think this can take us back to this ancient idea that can bring us together and find common ground for the common good. And especially, a new generation wants to give their lives for the common good. Our audiences are half under 30 everywhere I go. Okay. And they want to give their lives for this. And that's what I think is going to make a difference long term.
Jim, thank you very much.
My
Jim
pleasure
Wallace,
to be with you.
The book is On God's Side. In other news, on our calendar this weekend, April 7th is Holocaust Remembrance Day, Yom HaShoah. It's a solemn tribute to the 6 million Jews put to death by the Nazis during World War II. It may be difficult to imagine abandoning our cell phones and computers one day a week, or deciding not to run errands or do anything that resembles work. But for a family in a suburb of Washington, that's how they've chosen to keep the Sabbath, to get in touch with the sacred, to be close to each other, and just to be. Judy Valente reports.
There was a time in America when Sundays meant a day for worship, for leisure, for spending time with family and friends. But that was before the advent of round-the-clock shopping, cell phones, and email that place us on call 24 hours a day.
People are feeling the burden and the pressure of a fast-paced world and wanting to find some alternatives, a new rhythm of being, and how Sabbath is a part of that conversation.
It's an idea as old as the Bible, recorded in the book of Exodus, one of the Ten Commandments, in which God is said to have told Moses, remember the Sabbath, to keep it holy. In it thou shalt not do any work.
We'll just take a few minutes to tell the people at your table about that and why it creates Sabbath for you, or why it helps make Sabbath happen for you.
Now, a growing number of pastors is trying to help people reclaim at least one day of the week for Sabbath. Time set aside for spiritual, mental, and physical renewal, whether it's Sunday or even another day. It's been described as the most precious present mankind has received from the treasure house of God.
These clergy members are here to explore realistic ways that people can observe the Sabbath, despite all of the distractions and interruptions families face on a day that's supposed to be holy time.
Sabbath is the great leveler. I mean, if we take that seriously as a culture, it means that no matter what your life situation, whether you are Bill Gates or the person who cleans Bill Gates' office, you have an inherent dignity. And for a time each week, you do not need to defend your existence to prove your worth in the culture and in the marketplace.
There is a sense of, boy, I'm important. You know, I got 35 emails and I got 10 text messages today.
God didn't say, gee, you should take a day off. God said, remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. You know, oh, maybe take a day. Sure, take a day. No, it was, do this. This is my commandment.
We can think about it in a very fixed way, that it's one day where we don't do any work. But we can also think about Sabbath in, I think, a lot of different ways, and I think we can help our parishioners think about Sabbath in a different way.
Mary Ann McKibben Dana, a Presbyterian minister from Springfield, Virginia, chronicled her own family struggle to set aside one day a week in a book called Sabbath in the Suburbs, A Family's Experiment with Holy Time. Now she leads workshops across the country, trying to help others find some Sabbath time during each week.
We all left things undone to be here. Let it be. And I also find this a helpful way to start my Sabbath, is to say what has been done, what has not been done, let it be.
McKibben Dana was working full-time as a pastor and pregnant with her third child when she decided something in her hectic life had to change. She and her husband vowed to set aside one day of the week when they didn't work, run errands, shop, or return emails.
People ask us, well, how did you do that? How did you even make that work? Well, people do this, you know. I mean, the Jewish tradition still has a very strong component of Sabbath keeping to it.
But it wasn't easy. Because McKibben Dana is a pastor and has duties on Sunday, she and her family decided to observe their Sabbath on Saturdays.
And then I knock it down. No. Yes.
No, that's not how you play the game. We realized that in our own faith, we really have a resource in the Sabbath as an invitation from God, a command from God to say, one time a week, you set all that aside and you just enjoy one another and you enjoy God. We don't have to be anywhere. And they love to hear that. They call it the Sabbath, but they also call it the stay-at-home day. We'll light a candle to sort of remind ourselves that this is a time set apart. And we don't make a big deal out of that. We just have it there. We also may have music playing in the background, which puts us in a different kind of frame of mind.
The giant TV screen in the basement remains mute. The computer is turned off. The family doesn't use the phone to make calls, but it will accept calls from friends.
The church really is called, I think, to be a countercultural voice, to say, you are enough, you do enough. There is a time each week where you can just stop. I wonder if Margaret and Carolyn can get out the ingredients that are listed there, okay?
McKibben Dana stresses that observing Sabbath doesn't mean doing only things that seem traditionally religious or holy, but making holy the acts of ordinary life.
We'll put these in the oven and then we'll make lunch, okay?
For health and strength and daily food, we give you thanks, O Lord.
For some people, the idea of taking off an entire day either feels overwhelming or it really is logistically impossible. And so I tell people to start where you are. A lot of us don't have an entire day at our disposal, but we might have one morning on the weekend.
Oh, I see ducks in the water.
We love physical activity as part of our Sabbath. We love going to the state park near our house, and we've been able to see the changing of the seasons. And having the time on Sabbath to do that has really been very special for our family. Psalm 90 is one of those beautiful psalms about time and the passage of time. The psalmist says, teach us to count our days, that we might have a wise heart. And I think that's something that the Sabbath helps us to do, to be mindful about the passage of time. Sabbath helps us count our days and make them count, and not just be about doing and producing and more, 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 but to be content and to appreciate the gift and the beauty of this day that we have.
And perhaps reclaim something from Scripture, which says that on the seventh day, even God rested. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Judy Valente reporting.
Finally, in a study of 189 U.S. metropolitan areas, the Gallup poll has identified the most and the least religious places in the country. The Provo-Orin area in Utah had the highest number of people who said they're very religious, 77%. The lowest number was in Burlington and South Burlington, Vermont, with just 17%. Nationwide, 40% of Americans said they are very religious. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's much more on our website. You can watch more of our interview about keeping the Sabbath and read an excerpt from Marianne McKibben Dana's book, Sabbath in the Suburbs. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Be more. PBS.